Hey, real quick, I just wanted to let you know that Gabba Gabba Huh is now a record store. Well, not really a store, but a booth at an antique store located in Eastridge Mall in Gastonia, North Carolina. Vintage Village is three stores down from Dillard's on the left. And my booth is on the left side of Vintage Village. It's the one with all the records. You can't miss it. I've got over 1,000 records, toys, t-shirts, DVDs, VHS, all kinds of stuff there. So come check it out. Gabba Gabba Huh Records and Vintage Goods, located in Vintage Village at Eastridge Mall, Gastonia, North Carolina. This episode of Gabba Gabba Huh Talks is brought to you by Hobo Wolfman Records. You can find great music by bands like The Fill-Ins and The Body Bags, as well as weird toys like The Drunken Stumble Walking Jesus, hot sauces, t-shirts, all kinds of crazy shit over at HoboWolfmanRecords.com. And right now, for a limited time, use code GABBAGABBA at checkout for 30% off your entire order, including pre-orders. That's HoboWolfmanRecords.com. You are now listening to the Gabba Gabba Huh Talks podcast, where we bring you conversations with people connected to the Carolinas underground music scene. Your host, Mike Phillips of Van Huskins. Hey.
What's up, man?
How you doing?
Doing good.
All right, so that seems like it's going to work.
Yeah, cool.
Let me work with my audio here for a second.
Yeah, hey, yeah, sure.
So I've been seeing those reviews. You've been getting some really good reviews on the movie. It's awesome.
Yeah, it's been pretty crazy. It's a little bit unexpected, but, you know, definitely cool.
Yeah, I know I love the movie. It was really good.
Oh, thanks.
I like the Theta Girl. But I think I like Bad Girls better. It's just, they're both good, but Bad Girls is just a lot of fun.
Thanks. I like it better myself. I've had a couple people tell me that they like the first one, which of course that's not what you want to hear.
Yeah.
But, I think that, on a technical level, it's just, I mean, I know what I'm doing more.
Yeah.
I still don't completely know what I'm doing, but, I think each time you sort of learn from the mistakes of the previous.
Yeah, and that's kind of what you expect anyway. It's kind of like making records. The first one you're going to put out, it's going to sound like whatever it sounds like, and the next one's going to sound better. So,
exactly.
Yeah, and we'll talk about the movie and everything later. I do want to talk some about the music, and I know you've probably been busy lately talking about the movie a lot. I don't know how many like interviews you've done or what you've been doing with it, but I know you've been busy. So we'll start at the beginning. And as far as the bands go and music, we can talk about that as much as you want to or as little as you want to, because I know, you know, that's not what you're doing these days. But I still feel like, you know, it's important stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think that stuff's, you know, fairly interesting. You know, it was of its time, but, you know, I wouldn't want it to be forgotten about.
Oh, yeah. And then, of course, it ties into the movie because you use some of the music on your soundtracks. So.
That's right, yeah.
And I guess I'll go ahead and start with like my introduction. I usually kind of ease my way into it, but I'm talking to Christopher Bickle. I know you, I think we've only met probably once, and that was from you sang for 134 at Heretics in Charlotte one night.
Yeah.
And, I'm trying to remember which one of my bands played. It was either Popes on Dope or Style and Johnny Appleseeds, or maybe both of them.
It was Popes on Dope, I remember. Yeah. I can't believe I remember that. We played one show together. And it was a lot of fun. I wish I could have done more with those guys back then.
Yeah.
It was a weird thing. Their singer went on vacation, and they had a show booked, and rather than cancel the show, they hired another singer to do the show, and it was me. I was lucky to, and I didn't know any of their lyrics, and neither did they.
Yeah.
So I had to write new lyrics to all their songs for one night.
Yeah.
So it was weird.
And I love 134. They're such a great band, and Sam was a great singer. But it was really cool that night to be able to be there and to see that. And I think you've got there's one video of it up online, and it's cool to watch. Go back and watch that, because I can see like me and Eric and all my friends, everybody looking young.
yeah, it's crazy that was recorded at all. That exists out in the world, because it was just a weird one-off thing we did, and I mean, I thought it came out really good. I wish I could have like continued to play with those guys back then.
Yeah, it was a lot of that was a lot of fun. We'll be right back. So when you were a kid, what was it that drew you to music and made you want to be a little bit more of a part of?
Well, yeah, I was a latchkey kid starting from the third grade. And right around that same time, we got cable and MTV had just come out.
Yeah.
And so it like literally it was just I would get home from school and for the next 4 hours, I'd just be watching MTV. Like, yeah. That's all I did. Watch MTV for hours every day, and it was cool then, know, because they especially like in the first couple of years they were really starved for content because like the big name radio bands weren't making videos at first. It was all these like weird new wave bands that that kind of like dipped to what was coming, and so you know you're just seeing all this like weirdo new wave stuff that eventually. The radio had to start playing the stuff that was on MTV, and that's what everybody wanted. And so being a kid and being exposed to all that weird music really had a profound effect and made me, you know, just want to collect music. The first band that I can remember that I really got into where I had to have all their records, and it wasn't an MTV band either, like not till later, was Van Halen.
Yeah.
And That was the first band really where I was like I have to own every record this band made, and but then like 1984 came out and of course it was just huge, and then sadly you know David Lee Roth either quit or was fired, and I had no interest in the band whatsoever after that point.
Yeah, I stuck with them for a little while, but and I still like now I like the Sammy stuff a lot better than I did back then even. But it's a different animal.
I can give it more of a chance now, but the thing that I didn't realize then as much as I realize now is that it wasn't just Sammy Hagar. Like the whole band changed.
Yeah.
And they were really going for something different. And even Eddie's guitar sound changed. He stopped playing you know, Marshalls and he was playing PV amps. And I mean, you could tell us a difference in his guitar sound after the 1984 album, and it's weird to think that they sold so many more records after 1984.
Yeah, exactly.
They sold way more records with Sammy Hagar than they sold with David Lee Roth. But we look back now, and most people can't even like name a Van Hagar song. You know?
Yeah.
It's like all the classic Van Halen songs are with Dave, but it has as much to do with the songwriting. And the way the band sounded and the edge that they had as anything else.
Oh yeah, definitely. And I often talk about that era of MTV as well. You know, I feel like you know that when I grew up in the '80s, that the fact that MTV existed and was the way it was at the time. I mean, they played a lot of bands on there that were basically punk bands.
Yeah, it was revolutionary. I remember seeing a video for Kraut, the New York punk band. That got played on MTV before I wasn't really into punk then. I just saw this thing that I thought was weird and kind of cool.
Yeah.
And it was a few years after that really what got me into punk rock was I had a cousin who was into it and I was listening to a lot of heavy metal at the time. So, you know, my big Iron Maiden and Judas Priest, but he gave me the My War cassette from Black Flag, like right around the time it came out. And that just blew my mind because I'd never heard anything that heavy or lyrically that like resonated with what I was feeling. Because like the bands that I listened to were singing about girls, and that wasn't a part of my life at all.
Yeah.
And like you know, cars. I couldn't drive. Like you know, in Dungeons and Dragons. I mean, I played Dungeons and Dragons when I was a kid. But what I could relate to was like. Being depressed and feeling hopeless and feeling that everybody was you know out to get me and feeling kind of like an alien and that record was just like holy shit, like this record was made for me, and to this day that's you know the record if I had to give up my entire collection that's the one I would keep because it just got me through so many difficult times. You know there were times in my life where I probably wanted to give up the ghost, but then like I put My War on and I was like, oh, there's like one other person in the world that gets this.
Yep. So you're not originally from Columbia, are you?
No, I'm from Louisville, Kentucky.
Okay.
Originally. But my family moved around a lot. My dad was in construction, and I ended up going to three different high schools in three different states, which was tough.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're just, I mean, I was a weird kid anyway, so it was difficult for me to make friends, but it's way more difficult when you just have to, like, uproot yourself, you know, once a year and go to some total place. I was in Virginia Beach. That's where I got into punk rock, and that was my junior year of high school, and then from there we moved to Aiken, South Carolina for the last part of my junior year and then my senior year.
Okay.
And that was just a culture shock, because at that time, the two things that I was really into punk rock and I was really into rap.
Yeah.
And moving to a small South Carolina town in the late 80s, it was before Vanilla Ice made rap okay for redneck white guys.
Yeah.
It was really, like Kid Rock, you know, was a few years later.
Oh, yeah.
Vanilla Ice was really the gateway for, like, redneck white dudes to be in rap. So when I first moved to Aiken, it's just, like I was called a lot of names.
Yeah.
And but the black kids at school, like, also, like, didn't really want to be my friend either, and it was, you know, no fault of theirs or mine. It was just sort of the culture of that town. It was just so divided and so segregated. And so I really found solace in punk rock living in Aiken, South Carolina. I was one of probably three people in the whole town that listened to punk rock at that time.
Yeah.
And for me, it was just because, like, it just reflected hating. Like I hated Aiken, South Carolina. I hated high school.
Yeah.
It was just the culture there was gross. It was just like every weekend, everybody got in their pickup trucks and drove in circles around the Burger King.
Yeah.
That was the thing to do Aiken. Yeah, it was sick, and I just wanted nothing to do with it, and that's where I got way into punk rock, because it's sort of, it was a way for me to say, like, I don't want any part of any of this shit.
Yeah.
And so from there is kind of where, like, I eventually found, like, one of the other people in town that was a transplant from New York. He was into the New York hardcore scene and had, I guess because of his family, had to move to South Carolina. And so we ended up starting a band together called Tolerance, and that was the first band that I was ever in.
Okay.
Guitar player and I went on from Tolerance, and that was Inhumanity.
Did you ever record anything with Tolerance, or did you...
we did a demo tape, and actually the first to backtrack a little bit, I'd started a record label, because living in Aiken there was nothing there, so I would drive up to Columbia to buy records. There was a store called Manifest.
Yeah,
it was in Columbia, and it was just like the cool punk rock record store. And one of the times I drove up, there was a demo tape sitting on the counter. I bought, like, some Sex Pistols records or maybe a Crass record. And there was this demo tape that was $1 by a local band called Anti-Schism. I was like, well, I got $1. Like, I don't know anything about it, but it's like, it's punk rock and it's $1.
Yeah.
And I took that home, and man, like, that's all I played for, like, a whole summer.
Yeah.
It was demo tape. It was so cool. I mean, to this day, Anti-Schism is, like, the best band that ever came out of South Carolina.
Yeah.
And I loved it so much. And so I ended up, when I came up to Columbia for college, just by sheer luck, I met Kevin Bird, the guitar player from Anti-Schism. Like, the first day I was in Columbia, just, like, ran into a dude and started talking to him. And then he told me he was in this band. I was like, oh, shit. Like, I've been listening to your demo, you know, for months. So I decided to start a record label to put out a record for them.
Okay.
And so the first record that I put out on my label, Stereonucleosis, was the Anti-Schism End of Time EP. And then the second record that I did was a compilation called Stereonucleosis Comes to Your House. And that had my band Tolerance
on it, as well as Anti-Schism, a band called Unheard, who was a pre-S Factor 4 band, and then was the first ever release of Buzz Oven.
Okay.
Who I loved. Well, I didn't love him at the time. I loved Sewer Puppet, which was a North Carolina band that Kirk was in, who I thought were awesome. I had their demo tape, and I had asked Kirk if I could have a Sewer Puppet song for the compilation, and he's like, "Well, I have a new band now," and he sent me a track, and so I put out the first Buzz Oven song on that compilation. Tolerance wasn't a good band, and it's definitely the worst band on that compilation. But then we went on to do Inhumanity, and then I put out most of those records after that.
Yeah, and you did Inhumanity for quite a few years.
Yeah, and it went through a lot of changes too. Like when we started, we kind of had a different lineup, and we hadn't really kind of found our sound yet. Like we still had a lot of influence from the New York hardcore stuff that our guitar player was into, and then like. You know, I was really into like Crass and the Dead Kennedys and all this peace punk stuff, and so I was coming at it from a different place lyrically. And then as the 90s sort of began to take shape, we were taking in all these newer bands. Like hardcore sucked from like 1985 to like 1991. There's like nothing good from that period. But then as the early 90s came about, like there started becoming more and more of these kind of weird hardcore bands that were introducing sort of new sounds and were like way more chaotic. Yeah. And I really gravitated towards that because I wanted the most extreme stuff, you know, that I could possibly hear. And I wanted stuff that just didn't have melody or you know, as fast as it could possibly be played. And so the more we kind of got into these new bands like Born Against and Rorschach and all these San Diego bands, Antioch Arrow, and just like all this like really cool weird shit, we sort of incorporated a lot of those different sounds, but we were taken from a lot of different sources. And so I think the soup that we made with the ingredients was a little bit different from the soup everybody else was making. But, so I think by the time we had sort of changed some members and then done the Gets Killed by Robots EP was sort of when we became, like, the Inhumanity that most people know that's sort of associated with this term that I made up to be funny called emo violence.
Yeah.
Term like weirdly stuck around, and there are bands that still come out like now that call themselves emo violence bands, and it's weird because it was supposed to be a joke, but then I guess it is, for some reason it made sense to somebody and it stuck.
Okay. After that, was Guy on a Punchline the next thing that you did?
Yeah, So Inhumanity did two albums, a couple of tours. We toured Europe, and then our guitar player took a was supposed to be taking a break to join a band called Tarot Bolero, which featured a member of Antioch Arrow and a member of Slant Six. It was kind of a super group, and they were really cool. They weren't punk, really. They were kind of like a weird sort of cabaret band or something.
Yeah.
And that was supposed to just be like a temporary thing, him taking off with those guys, but then I think he kind of fell into like some drug use, some things like that, and then we just sort of fell apart.
Yeah.
And I was itching to do something else, and Kevin from Anti-Schism, then of Initial State, and then he did a band called Dot Fucking Com. He was without a band, and so we started talking, and of course, like I just, like I said before, I loved Anti-Schism so much.
Oh yeah.
And so it would be a dream come true to be able to play with Kevin, and so I said yeah, and that became Guyana Punchline.
Yeah.
And we did three albums and some 7-inches.
Got into punk rock. I went to the Milestone, and I'd been going to Charlotte to go to record stores and picking up some things, you know, bands that you'd heard of, you know. But we found out about the Milestone and went there on a Sunday night and saw Tonka play. So that was like the first punk band I saw was Tonka.
Also, Gas Factor 4.
Yep, I was going to say. So it all kind of led back to that. And then I heard Anti-Schism. I picked up an Anti-Schism 7-inch at Milestone Records, I think, or Repo Record, one of the two. And so all those bands from that time, even though I more like as time went on, I associated more with the North Carolina bands, but all those bands were part of my introduction to punk rock. So that was big reason why I wanted to include South Carolina when I started doing this. At first, I was just going to do like a Charlotte thing. Like, I'm going to just do a podcast about the Charlotte music scene. And I was like, no, I should do all of North Carolina. Well, no, I got to do South Carolina too, because there's a lot of good shit that came out of there. And living right here on the border, you know, it just makes sense because we were introduced to a lot of that stuff, especially once we got to be friends with 134.
Yeah, well, there was such cool stuff happening in Columbia in the early to mid-90s. You know, you mentioned 134, but, you know, we were doing stuff. Ass Factor 4 were just, like, crazy good and still have, like a really big cult following. Anti-Schism, which I mentioned, Initial State, which I think were even better than Anti-Schism. A band that I didn't really care for that much, but I thought they were really nice, cool dudes, was Stretch Armstrong, and they were kind of huge.
Yeah,
they like just really broke out big. It wasn't really my thing. I always kind of felt like at that time in the 90s, hardcore sort of splintered off into a lot of different directions. There were always different cores, and Stretch Armstrong were sort of just hardcore. Like, when I got into punk rock, it was punk was sort of interchangeable with hardcore punk or hardcore. It was all sort of the same thing. But as the 90s wore on, hardcore became its own thing. And I didn't really care for that. Like, to me, that was almost like pandering to an audience. Like I was interested in music that like almost alienated the audience. You know, if people tried to dance to it, like you would make it such that they couldn't dance, that you would confuse them with the tempo change or something. Where Stretch Armstrong kind of did a thing that I think was a sort of straightforward, like hardcore that sort of had become codified by that point. As where hardcore became something different from punk rock, mm-hmm. by the 90s, yeah. by the mid 90s, where like people would say like, well, you know, I like hardcore, I don't like punk rock. Like to me, like it all, like it was the same thing, but it definitely at that point became two separate things, and so I wasn't so much into hardcore yeah. at that point, but they were super cool guys, like really good dudes, and but that scene. From Columbia at that time, just had so many bands that were doing like cool stuff nationally and internationally. But in Columbia, like at Ass Factor 4 or my band or Premonition or any of these bands played a show in Columbia, we'd have 20 people. Yeah. Like just no gave a shit. Like Stretch Armstrong would have huge shows. Like if Inhumanity played a show, it was you'd be lucky if 30 people showed up. Yeah. But then we'd go on tour. And like we'd play in Italy and play to like 500 people in Italy, you know. So, yeah. But Columbia's always kind of been that way, where it's just like they don't really appreciate what's going on if it's weird.
Yeah, I think that goes for a lot of towns though. Like I mean, even in Charlotte, we get some decent crowds out, but you know, I think a lot of bands from Charlotte have done better in other places.
Yeah, and that's, like, especially when I was younger and I was really, like, tuned into the music scene and all that, like, you see some bands that are really good and they just never play outside of their hometown. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, 134, like, which we talked about, Jesus Christ, if those guys had toured,
yeah.
like, they could have been huge. Like, but you know, how many people outside of South Carolina ever saw that band?
Yeah.
Ever got to hear their records, you know? So that's, you know, one of the things that we were lucky that we got out, and that was just because we couldn't stand living here.
Yeah.
We wanted to go somewhere else. But then you do go other places and it makes you appreciate your home too.
Yeah.
You especially appreciate that it's cheap. Like Columbia is just like crazy cheap to live in. It's the reason I still live here.
Yeah.
So I can work record store and own a house.
Yeah.
Like I couldn't do that in Chicago or New York, you know?
Yeah. That's one of the good things about the South. I mean, there's a lot of bad things about the South for sure, but it's cheap, fairly cheap to live here.
Yeah. I mean, that's what keeps me in place. I mean, the people are, you know, if you have to look for the cool people, like, but you find them if you look hard enough.
Yeah. Yeah. Like even in the little town I grew up in, Kings Mountain, where I still live, just me and a couple of friends found each other, and then we found punk rock together, and it was, you just kind of had to find your people, no matter where you are, but they're there, they're people around.
Yeah. I don't know, like, I feel so out of touch with, you know, kids now, and I don't know what the experience of being a kid is like now, but I know when I was a kid, it's, you know, the whole punk rock thing, I mean, it was the music and all, but part of it was that you were part of a culture and you would dress a certain way. And that was a signal to like the other weird guy in your town mm-hmm. that like, oh, this guy might be cool. Cause he's got a Dead Kennedys t-shirt or,
yeah.
or whatever, you know, and you would actually go up and talk to that guy because like, there ain't nobody else you exactly. know, wearing a shirt, you know? So you might have some common ground and usually you did. I don't know what it's like for kids. Cause like, you know, when I was a kid, if you had like a weird spiky haircut or like a weird hair, like you get beat up. Mm-hmm. Like I mean, that just came with it, yeah. you know. Or if you didn't get beat up, you fought, and maybe you might win. But it's like now, like I see kids, and it just seems like a weird hair color or something like that. Like that's just normal.
It's all okay. normal. Yeah,
you're not going to get your ass kicked because you have purple hair.
Yeah,
you know. So I mean, good for them. Like, good for those kids, but also I don't know what it's like to be a kid and be looking for you know, the people that jive with you, but, you know, maybe you just, that's what the internet's for now.
Yeah.
I didn't have that then. So I imagine now, you know, if you were a kid and you were just getting interested in some weird music or a weird idea, like you would just find other people online.
Yeah. I think that's probably how it works. Fairly. Yeah.
But yeah, back then, like if you wanted to find anything, it was just, it was really like a hunt for it. And, you know, I don't know if it's better or worse now, but the hunt was kind of cool too. Yeah. You know, like you would go in a record store and you'd pick up a record and you didn't know anything about, you couldn't look up a review of it, you know, with thing in your hand. Like, so you just have to go by the artwork.
Yeah.
Like it had a cool skull on it. If this skull is cooler than the other skull, you pick the coolest skull,
yeah.
And then you take it home and hope that it sounded good. And then sometimes it didn't sound good, or at least the first time, mm-hmm. but then you spent your whole $10 that you had that week on buying that record, so, well, I better listen to it again, and you know, I'll play it a third time, and then by the third time you play it, you're like, oh, this is actually pretty good. Yeah, and so... You know, the difference between then and now is now, if you're a kid first starting to get into music and you played the first 10 seconds of a song and you didn't like it, in 10 seconds you would just turn it off. Yeah. And go to the next song. Because you got 10 million other songs you could play right at your fingertips.
Exactly.
Back then, it's like you had one album that you bought that week, and so you better play it a couple more times to make sure that it's not a total piece of shit. Sometimes it was a piece of shit.
Oh yeah.
You know, sometimes like a shitty exploited album that, cause it had a cool, like a cool skull on it, but the record sucked.
Yep.
You know, I still have a lot of those records in my collection.
Yeah.
You know, some of them might be worth money.
Yeah. I often say that that's why people don't appreciate music these days, is because it's so easy to find stuff that you just don't even search for it. Like you don't seek it out.
Yeah. It's like, you don't take the time to make it a part of you.
Mm-hmm.
like you know, back then, God, I feel so old like saying this stuff. You're like, well, back in my day, you'd play a record five times, but you did, and by the fifth time you played it, it sort of became a part of your soul.
Yeah.
You know, like it was ingrained into you, and there would be no reason to do that now, because like I said, after the first 10 seconds, if you think it sucks, There's a bunch of other stuff you can play.
Mm-hmm. And it's so easy to go back and listen to all the stuff you already know anyway, so why are you going to bother listening to something new? I think a lot of people just look at it that way. It's like, well, I can listen to this Led Zeppelin record again.
Yeah. Well, and I think there's just also a thing where you're a kid, like before the age 25, your brain is developing, like your frontal lobe is not developed, and as it's developing, anything you take in during that time sort of becomes a part of your brain.
Yeah.
I mean, this is like, I don't know if there's like a study to back this up. There might be, but anything you're taking in during that time, like it becomes a part of you, and you sort of lose that as you get older. Like the stuff that you listen, like the stuff that I listen to now, like I might think it's good. You know, like I think it's well done, but it's not going to become a part of my soul. And the same, you know, like what's a good example? Like The Weeknd. I think The Weeknd has some great hits.
Yeah.
And I like to listen to those. But are those songs ever going to become a part of my soul? Like, there's shitty songs by Rat that, yeah. that like are like subjectively shit.
Yeah.
That. Like, I can sing every word of it, like, and that's just a part of me. If you put it on, I'm going to have a big smile on my face because it's just a part of me. and once you pass the age of 25, you're not going to have that as much. And it's just because your brain is developed.
Yeah.
But, like, as your brain is still developing when you're young, you're just a sponge and you soak up all this stuff. And I don't know how it works now. Because kids are soaking up a lot more stuff,
yeah.
than, you know, were able to soak up when we were young. So but I don't know how different it is.
Yeah, I just don't see where people get that connection like we probably got when we were younger with stuff. Like, I mean, like you said, there's so much stuff out there. How do you find what you connect to so much? In a, I don't know what I'm trying to say. But.
Well, yeah, no, and the thing is like, we experience nostalgia, and our parents experienced nostalgia before us. It's like, when I was a kid, you know, there was like this wave of 50s nostalgia, you know, like Grease came out and Sha-na-na and all this shit. And that was the generation before me was sort of reliving their youth. And, you know, just as I, you know, like to play a Minor Threat video and remember what it was like the first time I ever, you know, heard Minor Threat. And you have nostalgia because that stuff becomes a part of you. I don't know if the generation now will experience nostalgia in the same way, because I don't know if the stuff is becoming a part of them.
Yeah.
It could be. Like I could be totally wrong. Like, they could just be sucking all this shit up. And, you know, it would be weird if nostalgia stopped.
Yeah.
because there was so much information. You had total information overload, and then you couldn't appreciate anything from the past anymore.
Yeah. So we could talk about some of the other stuff that you've done musically. I know, let's see, Eugenics.
Yeah, that was kind of a brief thing that I did with some guys. It was sort of like a post-punk kind of thing. I guess that's what we were trying. I don't know what we were trying to do. We had a couple of songs that I thought were cool that I was probably the weakest link in the band. Like, I've never been really a very good singer.
Yeah.
I just like in bands. But I've managed to put Eugenics songs in both of my movies. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to be my thing, is I think I'm just going to use the same song in every movie. just as my Easter egg.
Yeah.
Like going forward. That was cool playing with those guys. We weren't together for, I mean, maybe a year, but we put out like 3 7-inches in a year, which is crazy. We put out a demo, and then we somehow convinced 3 labels to put all the songs in the demo out. We probably shouldn't have. We probably should have waited and like gotten better and done an album. But we didn't last that long.
Yeah. And I saw, like, so Brain Fever was another thing I saw listed on your Discogs. And, of course, I've talked to Jay Matheson about Confederate Fag before. We can touch on that if you want to or not. I mean, it's, you know, and then Anacrid was another thing. So whatever you want to talk about of any of those, if they're worth.
I can do all those. So Confederate Fag is a band that I did with Jay Matheson that was originally just supposed to be like a one-off kind of a joke band to piss off some rednecks.
Yeah.
This was back when the Confederate flag was still on the State House. And we got together, like... one night and ended up at a party where some band had played, but then they left all their instruments set up, and then I ran into Jay at this party, and I think he was really drunk, And I was like, hey, man, there's some instruments. Let's do you know some songs? And so so we had like a couple other guys there and just started calling out like 80s metal songs. And we played these songs. So then we decided we would like make a band kind of as a joke and play like a one-off gig.
Yeah.
And then that just ended up being like we played for years doing that. So it was really silly.
Yeah.
And then Brain Fever is a thing that I did with some guys that I became friends with when I was back in Inhumanity, just some dudes from Florida that were really cool dudes, and I'd always wanted to play with them. And actually, I did play with one of the guys had become a member of Inhumanity for like one show.
Okay.
And so we did this record, and I think it came out really good. And I wish we could do more, but we all live in different corners of the country.
Yeah.
So it's just one of those things where, like, if the stars align and we could get together for like a week, because we got together for one weekend, wrote the songs, and then got together for another weekend and recorded them.
Yeah.
And so I'd like to do that again. I think that record turned out really good. And then the other thing is Anacrid, which is something I've been doing since 1991. It's experimental music. Like around that time, I was introduced to bands like Throbbing Gristle and Nurse with Wound and all this like kind of weird avant-garde stuff, and I thought that was cool, and I wanted to try to do something like that. And starting out, like that stuff is pretty unlistenable and bad, but as I went along, I think I did some pretty cool stuff, like some sort of cinematic soundscape stuff, and I put out several records under that name, and then. That's kind of what I do now is Anacrid stuff, but I'm doing that stuff in the context of movies. So I'm doing this sort of soundscape stuff, but
it just all goes into the movie.
Yeah. I don't know what something's happened to the audio on your end. It's not nearly as good as it was a minute ago. I don't know if you've done anything different over there or. Let me end this real quick and let's try to reconnect.
Okay.
Let me send you another invitation.
Okay.
See if that fixes it, because I don't know if it keeps like this, it's not going to be good for when we start talking about the movie stuff.
Okay.
All right. So give me just one moment. I'll send you another link here in just a second.
Okay, sounds good.
Let's see.
Okay, it's already better.
Okay. I don't have anything. Like, I don't have a video now, so I'm not sure how to get.
Hold on a second. I'll fix that.
Oh, there you are.
Yeah, I didn't realize when I restarted, I had to start my video back up, so.
Okay.
All right, so this, it's better now. I don't know what happened to it, but all of a sudden it was just like, gone.
Okay. How much bad audio did we have?
Well, in the karaoke thing, most of it, I might be able to use it. I'm going to have to boost it up or something, but I'm not real too worried about it. I was just kind of, okay. I had written down that note, and I was like.
Was it just when we were talking about the karaoke stuff?
Yeah, it was basically that part of it was all
okay,
kind of.
That stuff's not that interesting anyway.
Yeah, so. And I was going to say, if I can use it, I'll be able to use it if I need to.
Okay.
And that might even be like something I threw out as like a bonus thing. Was there anything more about the music that you wanted to talk about? We kind of went through it sort of fast, but the main thing I really want to talk about, or a lot of what I want to talk about, was the movies.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we kind of covered the music stuff pretty good. I don't think I missed anything there.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that I really did want to touch on, which I think I did, was just like how strong Columbia was during that time, just like how many cool bands there were then. And you know, I don't know what it's like now because I'm old, you know. I every now and then I'll see a flyer for a show and like the flyer will just be like Ask a Punk for the address. It's like, well, I don't know any punks. I'm 50. Yeah. And they probably don't want me there anyway. You know, it's like, you know, because I know what it was like when I was, you know, 18. It's like, who's the weird old guy here? You know, and you know, there's nothing wrong. Like kids should have their space.
But yeah, Columbia had a really good music scene. It still does. I mean, there's still some good bands out there, and we'll talk a little bit about that too, because I kind of wanted to tie that in with your movies as well, because you use a lot of local bands in your movies. But during the 90s, back when you were like really active, the scene, I think in general, not just Columbia, but Charlotte, Chapel Hill, all the respective towns had really good scenes back then.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's changed a little bit over the years. The music industry itself has just changed a lot. It caused that.
Well, yeah, I think part of it is that, you know, that when the internet came along, all of a sudden, you know, you have a social fabric, you know, in front of you, like your computer. Before that, like if you wanted to be social, like you had to go out.
Yeah,
like that was the ritual, was to go see a band and to, you know, meet people and talk to people. And, you know, if you take the social component out of that and put it somewhere else, well, there's no reason to even leave your house anymore. So music becomes much less important as far as being a gathering point.
Yep.
You could say that sucks, but it's just different now. Like, it's just a different time, and just sort of is what it is.
Yeah, I often say, too, that I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that the people that appreciate live music and the kind of music that we play anyway, we're all older. Like, there's not a whole lot of kids that are into going out to shows and stuff. Like, again, like we talked about earlier, it's just a different experience for kids these days. So people our age have all kinds of different things going on in their lives that it's just hard to get off the couch sometimes to just go out. So, like you said, they've taken that social aspect of it and made it convenient right here in the palm of your hand. So now it's so much easier to just to sit on the couch on a Saturday night.
Yeah, and, you know, part of me wants to say that that's sad, but if someone else, if their experience is that they're getting something out of being on the internet and talking to friends in a chat room or whatever, then, you know, more power to them.
Exactly.
To get some out of it.
But, yes.
But yeah, it's definitely doesn't make for, you know, interesting new bands. But maybe we've got enough interesting music.
Yeah.
You know, maybe no more music has to even be written after this point. Like, maybe all the good stuff's been written. I don't know.
I would say that, but there's a lot of really good bands out there, and there's a lot of people that I look around and see, like Mike Benson, still out there making music and making some really good, interesting music, you know. But
yeah,
it's not gonna sell records.
One thing I forgot about when we were talking about the bands that I was in was that I was in a short lived band with Mike called 431.
Oh yeah,
did a demo tape that we didn't do anything with. And once again, like I said about Nugenics, like I was the weak link in that band. Like those guys were too good, and I had hoped that they were gonna like find another singer. And keep working together, but I think the whole thing sort of fell apart. But I know Mike's doing other stuff now that's really cool. So
yeah, he's got like three different projects going on right now. So
yeah, I'm sure he does.
I haven't heard about. I've just heard about the third one, but I haven't heard it yet. I'm sure it's good though.
Yeah, he's just a brilliant dude.
Yeah, so good at what he does, and a big inspiration to me. And just I mean the fact that I met him and 134 at the age that I did. I mean it was sort of like. Sort of like finding those people from your hometown that you connected with. It was like I was finding people outside of my hometown, but yet still people that were doing the thing and really damn good at it too. It made me go, and they appreciated what we were doing. So that made me just want to keep doing it.
Yeah. It's funny. Like I remember back to like, it's weird. Like I don't remember a whole lot from that time. Like it's all a blur, but I remember that, that Mike had mentioned the name of your band, that like he was really excited about playing with Popes on Dope.
Yeah.
Like you know, and that's cool, you know, it's like just...
Oh, we were terrible. We cool sucked.
I think at that time, everybody was just excited about what everybody else was doing,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That's the way it still is. It's just I look around and I see a bunch of people my age all patting each other on the back going, yeah, we're playing rock and roll still. Right. But, you know, we're doing it for each other and we're having a good time doing it. So that's all that really matters anyway.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
So after you got out of music, well, maybe not after you got out of music, but you, before you really got into movies, you were also a little bit of a writer. You wrote for Maximum Rock and Roll for a little bit, I believe. Or am I wrong about that?
I was a columnist for Maximum Rock and Roll for a few years. And then I wrote for a website called Dangerous Minds for a while until basically Facebook changed their algorithm and killed like all of these content providers. And so Dangerous Minds is sort of hangs on by a thread now. They used to have like just all kinds of money coming in and they could pay their writers, and they just got to a point where there was just no money to pay the writers anymore. Yeah. So that's the reason why I stopped working with those guys. But that's right around the time that that dried up is when I decided to make a movie, because that's what I had wanted to do my entire life. And just it was just one of those things that you just put off, and you put it off and put it off, and then you realize, oh, shit, like, I never did that one. And so that's when I got together with a guy named David Axe, and we decided we were going to do a movie together. And so that was Theta Girl.
If you are disturbed or upset by depictions of terrifying graphic violence, hallucinogenic drug use, punk rock orgies, and nihilistic existentialism, you should not see The Theta Girl. If, on the other hand, you enjoy such depictions of frank, graphic adult material, this is the film for you.
Beg for your life.
Our father, our
name. I changed my mind. Shut up.
The fuck shut up.
There's a whole world we can't see. It's where the human race is headed, and Theta just helps us get there. I have no idea the kind of people you work for.
Okay, but they're not killers, Gacy.
We are Christ's executioners.
All right, shitheads. Truth Foundation's here.
The stuff makes people go crazy.
God damn it, what the fuck was this for?
So you said that was something you wanted to do your entire life. Were you like in love with movies as a kid too? I imagine kind of like me. You talked about MTV, but at the same time we got MTV and cable, we also had HBO and other movie channels. And all of a sudden, like, because even back then, like HBO showed some really weird stuff.
Yeah, well, like I was into horror movies from I think like around 4 years old. I saw Frankenstein on a creature feature show in Louisville, and I loved it, and so I was really into like any kind of monster stuff. But then it was probably 81 that Friday the 13th showed up on HBO, and we had just gotten cable, and I watched Friday the 13th when I was, you know, probably too young to be watching it.
Yeah.
But God, that just it's like, first it scared the shit out of me. But then I was like, this is the coolest thing ever. And then that was the golden era of slasher movies, and they were all on HBO or Showtime. So I was like watching all those things and just like so into it. And then I discovered Fangoria magazine and just like really just got deep into that stuff and really got into like all the makeup effects guys, like Tom Savini, and I had the Dick Smith book, and so I was doing like makeup effects stuff at home, and I was like, "This is what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna make scary horror movies." And so I ended up going to college, studying media arts, and I wanted to go into film. And the media arts program at USC sucked.
Yeah.
And they were really behind the times on everything, and they really were trying to dissuade students from pursuing a film career. Oh, they tried to like funnel people into doing like industrial videos and this shit, and I was like, oh, I don't want to do any of that. Like, that sucks. And they're like, well, if you want to make it, you have to go out to LA and you gotta, you know, get coffee for people on set. And I'm like, well, I don't want to do that either. That sucks too. So around that time that I graduated from college, I was working at Manifest Records, and then I just decided that, like, my two great loves were movies and music, and I was really into record collecting, and I just decided I was going to open a record store instead of going out to L.A. So I had a record store that I ran for 5 years, and at the end of 5 years, I was like, you know what, like, I wanted to make movies, so I'm wasting my time with this record store. I need to make movies now. And so I sold the store and bought a bunch of equipment and set out to make my first movie. And I started working on it. And I went to go to a shoot, and I stopped off to get a drink. And I was, like, gone from my car for, like, 15 minutes and came back out to my car. And somebody had thrown a cinder block through the window and stole all my gear.
Oh, shit.
And not only did they steal all my gear, but everything I had shot was also in the same bag. So everything was gone. Wow. And man, I just, like, went into a funk like I've never experienced in my life.
Yeah.
And so I moved back in with my parents for like a year, and just was totally depressed. And it's like my great life's regret. Two of my great life's regrets, looking back, was one was closing my record store, because it was doing pretty good when I closed it, and like it probably would have continued to have success. So I closed the store for this to chase this dream, and then like the first hurdle I had, like, I just dropped it.
Yeah,
and that's my major life regret, is that I didn't get back on the bicycle after I fell off. And so then, like, I just went into this, like, depression for, like, a year, and then just went back to working at a record. I went to work at Papa Jazz, where I still work to this day, and it's a great job. Like, I love it. I have fun, and everybody I work with, they're all really cool. But then I just sort of let that dream of doing the film, like, escape me for a really long time until, like, around 2017, where I was like, you know, fuck me, like, I'm supposed to be, like, I dropped the ball, like, I should have, like, picked it back up, and I should be doing this. So I gotta just at least try it and see if I like it and see if I can do it. And so then I did, and then I liked it.
Yeah,
thought it was cool, and surprisingly to me, a lot of other people liked the movie that I made, even though, like, I watch it and I see all the mistakes in it.
Yeah.
But, you know, other people seem to be forgiving of those mistakes, and they walk away, they see the, like, there's rough edges to it, but they walk away from it and they had a good time.
Yeah.
And so that's the most important thing, is that somebody leaves the movie and they had a good experience with it. So then that led to doing the second movie, and so, you know, it just came out like, I think the 11th, so that's just like a few days ago. So far the response has been really good. People seem to like it.
Yeah. So you didn't write the Theta Girl, did you?
No, no. A guy named David Axe wrote that. So what happened with that is he, was trying to become a professional script writer, and he has like an agent in Hollywood and all this stuff. And he had written several scripts. His agent would shop them around and they would almost get made. And so what happened was he had the script and like it almost got made, and they supposedly had a producer attached to it, and they were shopping it around to some actors, and they were trying to like raise funds, da 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 da, and then it just fell through. And we were hanging out one night, we were drinking, and he was bummed about what had happened, and I was like, dude, like, you're trying to get your scripts made. Like, I've always wanted to make a movie. Technology exists now where it's cheap, you know. I had a friend in town, a guy named Tommy Faircloth, made a feature film, and he spent like $8,000 on it. I was like, you can make a movie for $8,000. Like, do you have any money? Like, I can put some money in. We can pool our money, and we could make a movie. And he was like, yeah, that sounds great. Like, are you serious? I was like, well, I think I am, but we're both drunk, so let's ask each other tomorrow. Like, if we're serious, so. So the next day, we're like, do you are you serious? Do you really want to make a movie together? And, you know, we both said yeah. And so he wrote it, and then we kind of produced it together, and I directed it and edited the thing, and so that's how Theta Girl came about.
Yeah.
It was really just because this guy, like, was frustrated not being able to do things within the system. And I come out of punk rock, and I'm like, you don't need the system.
Yep.
You know, the system, like isn't there to help you. You know, you could just make your own shit. You know, that's the lesson from punk rock, is that Jesus Christ, like if Inhumanity tried to get a record deal, you know, like we really need RCA to put out our record. Like, well, that's not going to fucking happen because, you know, we're Inhumanity. Like, nobody wants to listen to this shit other than, like, a tiny, tiny handful of people. But if you put out your own record, then there's some weird guy in Osaka, Japan that's going to love it, you know? And I figured it the same way with movies, you know? Like, if you can do it affordably, where, you know, you can cough up the money to do it, to where you can make a product that's watchable, you know, everybody in the world's not going to love it, but there's going to be a few weird people that are going to think it's cool.
Oh, yeah.
And that's exactly what happened. Like, you know, there's enough weird people in the world. You know, like, Theta Girl's played all over the world in festivals. And I got an email from a guy in Italy the other day, like, talking about how much, you know, he liked it. And so that's cool. Like, to me, movies are the new, like, punk rock.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, to me, like, putting out Bad Girls, that's a demo tape, you know? It's because it's got the rough edges of a demo. You know, this isn't, you know, we didn't go into a $1 million studio and cut an album. Like, this is just fucking, you know, playing three chords, mm-hmm. you know, and with, you know, like a boombox, except it's a movie.
Yep. Going in there and knocking it out in one take when you can.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, of course, like, making a movie is a lot harder than making a record. I've described it as trying to make 10 albums at once. Because each part is an album.
Oh, yeah.
Like, doing, like, figuring out all the camera shit, that's an album. Figuring out how to light stuff correctly, that's an album. Figuring out how to direct actors is an album. The sound shit is an album. But if you can make those 10 albums at once, then you really got something cool, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's, I think, what Bad Girls is.
Yeah.
It's just like 10 punk rock demos playing at once.
So these are released as under, what is Colacita? Is that, I don't know if that's how you would say it, films? Oh, yeah.
Colacita.
Colacita.
Cola comes from Colombia.
Yep, that's what I figured. Is that just a label you release it under, or is it another entity?
No, that's me.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah. So, Cola is for Colombia, and Chita is city. It's Italian.
Yeah.
And I just love Italian movies, especially, like, 80s Italian horror stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a bit of an homage to like, the classic Italian cinema. And that's films Cola Chita.
Yeah. So you self-made, self-released. That's punk rock as you can get, really.
Yeah. Well, the thing with the first movie with Theta Girl, we did all these film festivals for like a year, and because we thought, you know, we're going to find a distributor. I mean, we found supposedly a distributor, but then the thing fell through, and we basically ended up putting it out ourselves anyway. And it struck me how stupid I was to not realize that movies are the exact same as music, yeah. As far as that stuff goes. It's like I don't know why I was looking for a distributor, because it's the same thing as being in a band and looking for a record label. It's like, you got to remember, you know, I'm sure it was like this where you lived. It was definitely like this where I lived. There's always those bands that, like, the bands that thought they were going to make it bands.
Yeah.
You know, like that was their whole reason to exist, was they had the pro gear and the pro attitude.
Yeah.
And they were going to cut a demo, and they were going to send that demo to every label in the country, and they were going to be the next Nirvana, or the next Hootie and the Blowfish, or
yeah.
the next whatever. And, like, the chances of that happening are, like, one in a million.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, and you could be that band, or you could be the band that, like, puts out your own shit and tours the world, and you're not going to be famous, and you're not going to make, you know, $1 million, but you're gonna have fun. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, that's what I want to do. I want to be in the band that has fun, not the band that like risks everything on the demo and then like is disappointed and then just like is a sourpuss at the bar for the next 30 years. Like, I know, you know, these guys, it's just like, they're fucking depressed because they never made it. It's like, you fucking have fun. And so to me, like, that's what we're doing now with the self-distribution. It's like, we won't get it, you know, in front of as many eyeballs as the movies that are on Netflix, but the people that do see it, like, are going to have fun with it. Yeah, you know, they're going to dig it.
Yep.
So that's the route, you know, for me going forward is just fucking do it, you know, Discord style, SST style, yeah. You know, just put out your own shit and, you know, hope that, that somebody likes it enough to tell their friends about it.
Yeah. So how soon after Theta Girl did you decide you wanted to do another one? Was it just pretty much as soon as it was done before it was even released?
Yeah. I instantly wanted to do another one. What sucks is that, I've written a script, well, I co-wrote it with my friend Shane Silman, mm-hmm. who also co-wrote Bad Girls. We wrote the script called Sister Vengeance, and it was supposed to be a vehicle for Victoria D'Onofrio, who was the star of Theta Girl,
yeah.
because I just thought she was a really great actress, and I wanted to write something that would be challenging to her. So it was the story of these twin sisters and who got separated, and then they end up coming back together under some bizarre circumstances. And Victoria ended up moving right when we finished the script, so then we had to try to find someone else who could do it, and that was just a pain in the ass. Like, when you live in a small town, the people that are talented tend to move away
yeah.
from the small town. So you only have, like, so much to work with, and we ended up finding a girl from Atlanta that, like, fit like the image I had and also like could act, like she was really talented and she seemed like to be the one, and she came up, she auditioned, she was great, and we cast her, and then like a week before we were going to start shooting, she came back to me and she said, well, I don't think I can make this trip up from Atlanta every weekend for like 3 or 4 months no. that you need to shoot. It's like, I understand. So she bowed out at the last minute. And I was like, well, we're left without someone who can pull off this kind of difficult dual role. And so I tried to recast it, and I set a goal. I was like, if I can't recast this in 6 months, then we're just going to drop it and write something else. And after 6 months, I couldn't find anybody else that fit the bill. And so put the script on the shelf and just started writing a new one. So that wasted a year
yeah.
of just trying to, like, get that thing off the ground, and then it's sort of falling on its face. But I knew that, you know, I had to, like, move on and do something else. Like, I couldn't get, like, stuck
yeah.
on that thing. So that's when I started working on Bad Girls with Shane, and that took maybe 6 months to develop that script, and then we cast it and then shot it. And then it took like 3 months to shoot, and then it took like 8 months to edit, and then it was done.
What's the worst thing you've ever done?
You're talking about the worst thing you ever did?
What's the worst thing you ever did?
Mike makes right.
What am I supposed to do with this?
Where's the pussy action around here?
Look like Casanova here. We're gonna take no for an answer.
You even heard of Desert Storm?
We didn't come here for a history lesson, Full Metal jack off. Hey, asshole! The left lane is for fucking passing!
Fresh baby lamb chops. Most. After a rain. And the last one, citrus.
Let me do some drugs with you.
Manja manja.
Next
You need to back the fuck up!
I thought she was coming, but she wasn't. She was dying.
You're not suggesting that these three twats are heroes.
I don't think we're in any danger.
Daddy issues. Here's the good part.
What the fuck happened to my house?
What's the worst thing you've ever done?
I kind of destroyed a church. On accident.
They're girls. Very.
Thank heaven for little girls.
Shit!
So when you shot the movie, has COVID started at that time, or did you get it all shot before that became an issue?
We got so lucky. We finished our last shot, I think, 2 weeks before the lockdown.
Yeah.
So if we had been any later, like, it would just fucked the entire thing. So that was just a stroke of luck.
I kind of figured you had to have, because otherwise it probably would have held it up a lot longer.
Yeah, yeah. Like, we wouldn't have a movie at all, I think, if it had been shifted, like, 1 month.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was just, like, good timing for us. And then it took longer to edit than I had anticipated. But part of that was, it was kind of done, but then you have to take the finished movie and hand it over to a guy to do the score, and that took longer than I thought it was going to take. But, you know, you don't want to rush that. You don't want somebody to make shitty music. The score this guy Matt Akers did for Bad Girls is cool. So, like, about three-quarters of the music is him, and then the other quarter of the music is divided between soundscape stuff that I do and then the band stuff that's there. So that's the main one took for me is Boo Hag. Yeah. I just, like, they put out their album, I think, right before I started editing, and I heard it. I was like, oh, like, I have to have this band in the movie. This is so cool. And so I contacted them, and they were definitely down with it. And I knew, there was one song in particular that I just knew would fit so well for the drug trip scene, because it was like, to me, it sounded like a swampy version of Hawkwind.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is psychedelic as fuck and just, like, cool. It has, like, this nice crescendo to it. And so, to me, my favorite scene in the entire movie is the scene that has their song playing it, trip scene. I think that turned out really well.
Really well, and they are such a great band, so it's good to hear that, and good to hear, like, other local music in the movie too. I think that's just so cool that you do that, and it makes sense because it's punk rock filmmaking, so you're going to put in some punk rock music. And there's a lot of Easter eggs in the movie for people if they're paying attention. Like, even the fake flyers that you've got are based off of stuff that people will recognize.
Well, some of the flyers are flyers from the Theta Girl. They have the fake bands from Theta Girl.
Yeah.
And then some of the flyers are from my bands. And then some of the flyers are just classic, like, 80s punk rock flyers that have just been fucked with.
Yeah, they've been rearranged.
You can sort of tell that it's a Fear flyer, but it doesn't say Fear.
Yeah.
Or you can tell it's a Black Flag flyer, but it says, like, La La Fla.
Yeah.
It's like they're just, like, all kind of fucked up. And that was fun, like, making all the weird fucked up fake flyers. And we offered that in our crowdfunding campaign, because all the flyers kind of got glued down to a large sheet of paper that we could sort of, like, put up as like wallpaper in the set that we had. And so then when we were done, I think it was like maybe $80 you could buy the sheet with all the flyers on it. Yeah. And so somebody bought that.
And I wanted to ask, I do want to talk more about the campaign as well in a minute, but I wanted to kind of ask, other than the obvious one, which I don't want to spoil for anybody that's watching the movie that hasn't, you know, were the other bands, were any of the bands based on anything out of reality, like any real bands?
Well, one of the bands is, the music is Shane Sillman, who co-wrote it with me. He used to be in a band called Hand Over Fist.
Okay, yeah.
And they recorded a demo that just was fucking cool that never came out. Like, they recorded a demo and then broke up before they put it out.
Yeah.
So it was like this cool, unreleased demo. And I was like, Shane, I'm going to release this whole fucking demo, like, but it's going to be over the course of, like, 10 minutes. So... One of their songs is in Beta Girl, and then one of their songs is in Bad Girls. And there's a band called Christmas Tits, and their music is Hand Over Fist.
Okay.
And then there's a band called Poltergasm, and their music is Nugenics, but with a different singer.
Yeah.
And so Nugenics had a song called Every Girl in the World, and I used that in Theta Girl, where I had this girl named Deborah Dedek, and she came in and she re-recorded the vocal track. And so then I got this guy Artie to come in and re-record the vocal track. So I think what I'm going to do with every movie I do is going to have Every Girl in the World in it with a different person singing it.
Okay. That's a pretty good idea.
Those are the real songs. Like, the bands themselves aren't really based on anything other than just, you know, what I came up with. Other band, like Isabel's Gift, has a song in the movie briefly, mm-hmm. and Sign Zoom Toad is Jamie Clark's band. Jamie Clark is the guy that did all the visual effects stuff, and he just has this crazy fucking techie grind band. And so, like, all the violent scenes, like, that's their stuff. Yeah. And because what I had in mind is like I was thinking of John Zorn's Naked City.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever listened to Naked City? Like that's what I thought, like, I wanted for the violent scenes. But then it just so happened that, like, there was a local band that, like, I mean, they didn't have the saxophone parts, but, like, they definitely had, like, just the fucking crazy, just, like, nuts, grindy, kind of techie stuff. So that's them.
Yeah. And I also think you mentioned the I was about to say the Christmas tits, but you mentioned Christmas tits. I like the fact that you put in the, that was hilarious to me, that the argument, or not really the argument, but it's not, it's just Christmas tits. Cause I think anybody that's in a band can relate to that.
Yeah. I mean, that's just like from working in a record store for years and dealing with, you know, people who's like, you know, always have to quibble over if a band has the in it or not. You know, it's like, you know, it's not the Dead Kennedys. It's just Dead Kennedys.
Yeah.
It's like, who cares? Like, that doesn't matter. But that's the sort of thing that some, like, arrogant band guy would have to go off on.
Yeah. So I love that. That was part of one of my favorite parts of the movie. But that's just because I'm in a band and I know bands like that.
Yeah, I definitely heard somebody say that before.
So I guess it had to have been a lot easier making Bad Girls than it was Theta Girl. You surely learned a lot, were more prepared for it. But were you able to use anything you learned from Theta Girl to make it like super easy for the next one?
I mean, it definitely was easier. And I think the next one will be more easy than this one.
Yeah.
It's you know, the whole thing is you make mistakes and you learn from them. You know, it's just like, in a way, like a mistake can be a good thing, just in that, you know, you'll never do it again.
Mm-hmm.
And so with this movie, there's just like all kinds of things I did that just made me have to take up a lot of time in the editing. And because I'm the editor, it's like the editor me is mad at the cinematographer me,
mm-hmm.
or the director me. And so the editor me says, when you're directing next time, you better not fucking do that again. And so, you know, hopefully the next one will be easier. And if I can shoot it in a way that like makes more sense for the editing, then it will make everything go much quicker.
Yeah.
Like, there's no reason I should have taken 8 months to edit this movie. That's absurd. So it'd be nice if I could get these production times, you know, not down at least like a few more months.
Yeah. And we mentioned the Indiegogo a little while ago. That's the campaign you used to raise money for. And you already made the movie before you started the campaign, correct? So you paid for everything up front?
Yeah. Well, to a degree, when I first decided I was going to do the movie and I announced it to social media, I kind of put out there like, hey, we are trying to raise a little bit of money for the pre-production.
Mm-hmm.
And so I offered a few things that could sort of, people could sort of buy their way into Easter eggs in the movie. So, well, one thing was like people could buy in as like product placement.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a local brewery, River Rat Brewery.
Yeah.
Their beer is really good. And so like they gave me money to put their beer in the movie and to have like their logo and stuff. And so there's a few companies like that. Feral House Publishing gave me some money to put their books into the movie. And then we did a thing where I think if you paid like $100 and sent in your photo, you'd be a wanted poster hanging in the FBI office.
Yeah.
So a lot of people that did that, like they have their name and their photo hanging up in the office. And so we raised a little bit of money doing that, and then the rest of the money came out of my pocket. And then when it was done, we did the Indiegogo campaign as kind of a pre-order campaign. And we were only trying to raise $4,000, which was the cost of producing the Blu-rays, because it was really important to me to do physical media on this. And then just the thing went nuts. And we've raised almost $20,000 on the Indiegogo campaign. So I paid off, you know, all the money that I had to sink into it, and then the movie's actually has made some money. So, of course, all that money will go towards making the next one.
Yeah, I knew it was a pretty successful campaign, so that's awesome. I mean, but I mean, it's a good way to fund anything these days, because it's not cheap to do stuff. And
right. I mean, it's hard to do these campaigns, mostly because a lot of people have given money to campaigns and they got ripped off.
Mm-hmm.
Where like they sunk money into a thing, and there's really no guarantee that you're gonna get something back. You're pre-ordering a thing, but there's not a guarantee that you're actually gonna get it.
Yeah.
And I've put money into campaigns before, and then just like the money went away, and I never, nothing ever, like, came into my hand as a result. So it's harder than it was, say, 5 years ago to do one, but you can still do them. You just have to, like, convince the shit out of people that you're actually going to make the thing,
yeah.
And that they're going to get it, and they're going to get it and be happy with it. So this one was a lot easier than the first one, just because enough people liked the Theta Girl that they were like, okay, like, he can make a movie, and he will finish it, and I might like it, so I'll give him money for this one.
Yeah.
And so that's what happens. And so the hope is that you can just kind of keep that going, where people know they trust you enough that they're going to go ahead and send you $25 for a DVD that they might get 8 months down the road.
Yeah. And that campaign's still going. That's where you can still buy the movie. Like, if you want to watch it right now, that's where you'd go, correct?
Yeah. So with Indiegogo, you know, the campaigns usually last a month or 2 months. But if you hit your goal, they give you the option to keep the campaign going, mm-hmm. which we did, because one of the promises that I made in the campaign was that the people that donated to the campaign would get to see the movie first. And I, you know, you can't, like, that's one of the few things that you can give someone that's sort of like a leg up on the rest of the world, is like if you support my campaign now, you're going to see this before anybody else can see it.
Yeah.
So the Blu-rays aren't finished yet, so I want to make sure that everybody gets their Blu-rays before we put the thing on Amazon or any kind of public streaming sites. So it's probably going to take 2 more months for the Blu-rays to get done. And then once those are done and they're shipped out, I'll probably still get another month before I take it, you know, quote unquote, to the public. So people can order the movie through the website now. And so if somebody orders a digital copy, I send those out within 24 hours.
Yeah.
If somebody orders a Blu-ray, I also send them a digital copy within 24 hours. So even though they might have to wait 2 months for the Blu-ray, they can have a digital copy right away to watch it that will tide them over until they get the physical product in their hand.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm looking forward to having the Blu-ray. Theta Girl, I had to get the VHS. I thought that was pretty awesome that you did that. So, but I'm looking forward to having the Blu-ray for Bad Girls. It was a really good movie. And I'll probably watch it again before I have the Blu-ray, honestly.
Awesome.
Is the link for the Indiegogo, is it something easy to remember? I'll put it in the description for this, but is it something that you could say, or is it?
Oh, the easiest thing to remember is just www.badgirlsmovie.com.
There you go.
And if you go there, it has links to both the Indiegogo, and we also have an Etsy page for like t-shirts and stuff like that.
Okay, cool. Let me see. I wrote a few notes, so I'm going to make sure I kind of covered everything. The what's next, okay. I guess I wrote that down, but you've already said you want to make another movie. Is there any chance that you'll revisit Sister Vengeance, or is that probably just on the shelf and unless somebody comes along that you think can play that part?
I would like to go back to that at some point, but I really want to do a horror movie next.
Okay.
So here's the thing. I like Bad Girls, and I think it turned out good, but The Theta Girl was a horror movie. Now, if you want to try to promote a horror movie and try to sell a horror movie, it's really easy because there's like 10 million blogs devoted to horror movies, and you can always find somebody to write about it and review it and promote it. But Bad Girls is a road movie.
Yeah.
And there are no blogs about road movies. So it becomes a much harder sell. And I mean, I love horror movies anyway. It's my favorite genre. But just what I realized once I finished Bad Girls was, like, this is going to be hard to sell because there's not, like, a built-in genre audience for this kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I definitely want to do a horror movie next just because I want to try and make my money back, but make enough money to where I don't have to, like, beg for money every time I do it. Like, it'd be nice to make it sustainable.
Yeah.
Where each movie could make enough money to fund the next movie.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think I'm going to get rich doing this, and I also don't think I'm going to ever have, like, enormous budgets, but if I could raise, like, you know, $15,000 with each one to put towards the next one, then I could make a movie every year for the rest of my life, and that'd be cool.
Oh yeah.
And I'd just be happy to have that in my life, to just make, you know, a movie until I die every year.
I mean, like Lloyd Kaufman figured out how to do that and make, you know, interesting, crazy movies that fall outside the mainstream. So you can definitely do it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, that's the goal, is just to be able to keep doing it punk rock style.
Anything else you want to talk about, or that I didn't think to ask you? Because I always ask that question, like, because sometimes I just don't think to ask certain things, or that you might want to talk about.
I think that covers it. I mean, you know, we talked about the music stuff, and you know, my head is just like all in movie stuff right now, and so that's it's almost hard for me to like think about anything else other than the movie stuff.
Yeah,
and. So where I'm at right now is I'm just like stuck in trying to promote the thing, and I'll do that for at least like another month or two, and then as soon as I feel like I've tended to that garden well enough, then it's just back to trying to write the next one.
Yeah.
And so like I'm just like a one track mind right now.
Heck yeah, I understand that, and I'm looking forward to it for sure. This has been a Gabba Gabba Hunt Media production.